From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why homegrown marijuana plants are more potent today than in the 60s. We talk with Michael Pollan, author of the book The Botany of Desire, the story of how we have bred plants that fulfill our desires. It's just out in paperback. Also, film critic John Powers reviews The Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood, the new adaptation of the best-selling novel by Rebecca Wells, and Ken Tucker reviews the new hip-hop album by CeeLo Green. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is calling on Congress to act quickly on his proposal to create a new Department of Homeland Security. Legislative leaders say they'd like to get something done before the end of the year. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The president told a bipartisan group of lawmakers in a meeting at the White House that the sooner his bill is enacted, the better. He wants to merge several agencies into one new Homeland Defense Department. He's asking Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge to testify on Capitol Hill about the need for such an agency. His refusal earlier to allow Ridge, a presidential advisor, to testify is one reason many lawmakers have called for a new cabinet-level department. Senate Governmental Affairs Committee Chairman Joseph Lieber said he hopes to hold hearings on the president's plan soon. He had this to say when asked who he wants to hear from.
Obviously, the first person would be Governor Ridge. Right. That would be just for the thrill of it.
Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
An American missionary was killed today and his wife was wounded as Filipino soldiers attempted to rescue them from a Muslim rebel group that's held them hostage for more than a year. Martin Burnham and his wife Gracia were apparently shot during a gunfight between soldiers and rebels on the island of Mindanao in the southern Philippines. A Filipina nurse who was a captive with the Burnhams was also killed. Gracia Burnham was treated for her wounds and is being returned to the United States. The Filipino soldiers who conducted the rescue attempt were trained by American forces. The Pentagon says the Americans helped with planning and technical support for the operation, but did not take part in it directly. U.S.-led coalition forces in Afghanistan say they've captured an al-Qaeda weapons storage barn in a tiny village near Kandahar. NPR's Ivan Watson has more.
U.S. military spokesmen are calling yesterday's operation a success. More than 100 American special forces and British Marines raided the village of Atzalai, north of the southern city of Kandahar. Journalists were later shown a mud brick barn, where the troops said they found weapons, documents, and 25 tubes of plastic explosives. Five locals were also taken prisoner. For months now, U.S.-led coalition forces have been hunting around the country for signs of an enemy that has either taken shelter with the local population or fled across the frontier to neighboring Pakistan. Guerrilla fighters periodically retaliate with nighttime attacks. No one was captured after four rockets were fired at a coalition base near Kandahar last Tuesday. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Kabul.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 35 points to close at 9,589 in very heavy trading of 1.8 billion shares. For the week, the Dow lost 335 points. The Nasdaq lost 19, or 1.2%, to close at 1,535. The Nasdaq was down 80 for the week. This is NPR News. The Space Shuttle Endeavour has linked up with the International Space Station, where it will deliver a replacement crew and pick up the two Americans and one Russian who've lived aboard the station for more than 6 months. The shuttle will remain docked to the space station for the next 8 days while astronauts repair part of the station's robot arm. By the time they return to Earth, American astronauts Carl Walz and Daniel Birch will have spent 194 days in orbit. Grammy winner R. Kelly was booked by Chicago police today on child pornography charges after being released from a Florida jail yesterday. Chicago Public Radio's Jason DeRose reports.
R. Kelly left the Cook County Criminal Courts building this morning without comment after posting a $75,000 bail bond. The child pornography charges stem from a videotape authorities say shows the R&B singer having sex with a minor. Kelly has denied he's the man in the video. If convicted, he could be sentenced to 15 years in prison and fined up to $100,000. Chicago police and Cook County prosecutors say they interviewed about 50 witnesses in their investigation before determining the tape showed Kelly with an underage girl. FBI forensics experts say they also found the tape to be authentic. The singer, who lives in a Chicago suburb, is best known for his Grammy Award-winning anthem, I Believe I Can Fly. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
A judge in Santa Rosa, California, sentenced a Roman Catholic priest to 7 years in prison today for sexual abuse of a 13-year-old girl. Prosecutors said the Reverend Don Kimball committed the crime in a church rectory in 1981. Kimball was acquitted of raping a 14-year-old girl in 1977. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why are some American apples sweeter than they were in Johnny Appleseed's day? Why are American marijuana plants today more potent than they were in the 60s? And what separates today's genetically engineered potatoes from other potatoes? These are some of the questions Michael Pollan answers in the book The Botany of Desire. It's just been published in paperback. He examines how we have set about breeding plants that suit human desires and in doing so have affected the evolution of plants. He focuses on apples, potatoes, marijuana, and tulips. He's an urban emigre, a former magazine editor, who gave up city life for the country. I spoke with him last year when the book was first published in hardcover. I asked him why he chose marijuana as one of the subjects of his book.
One of the very key things that plants do for people is intoxicate them. Every culture on Earth, with one exception, has had a psychoactive plant that they use to change consciousness. The one exception are the Eskimos, and the only reason they didn't was because nothing would grow where they lived. If you're going to look at the relationship of plants and people, you really have to look at an intoxicant. And it could have been the grape, and it could have been the opium poppy, but I just thought the story of the marijuana plant was such a fascinating one, and I had some direct experience of it, so it seemed like a good one to delve into.
Now, as you point out in your book, homegrown marijuana, marijuana that was grown in the United States, in the 1960s and 70s was very weak. So a lot of people who tried to grow it and smoke it were very disappointed in the results. Why was it a not very effective intoxicant in the 60s and 70s when it was grown in the U.S.?
Well, it was a tropical plant, and it grew very powerfully in the tropics, in places like Hawaii and in India, where it's grown very commonly. But when people took the seeds from the marijuana that they bought, which was mostly marijuana that had been grown in Mexico, very carelessly, in fact, these plants wouldn't do very well here. And one of the great ironies of the drug war is this plant that really did not have much of a purchase. I mean, looking at it from a natural history point of view, on the American continent, this wasn't really its habitat, except for a few corners in Northern California and Hawaii. So it took the drug war, really, to create an environment in which this plant could thrive here.
What did the drug war do to create an environment that helped the plant thrive here?
It's a funny environment, really, because it consists of closets and basements. So you have to stretch your understanding of environment. But basically what happened, it's almost like the Newtonian principle of, you act here and you have an equal and opposite reaction. So basically with the drug war, you had people spraying paraquat, an herbicide, on the Mexican marijuana. And then Ronald Reagan sends the helicopters into the hills of Humboldt County to rout out the people growing there.
Humboldt County, California.
Yes, excuse me, which is sort of the original hotbed of domestic marijuana and one of the few. And they forced the growers indoors. And once they forced the growers indoors, the plant had, as it turned out, this wonderful opportunity. If it could do two things, if it could provide a sort of a feeling, a magic, so powerful that people were willing to risk their lives and their property for it, and if it could adapt to this strange new environment growing indoors under these 1,000-watt lights 24 hours a day, and all these high-tech fertilizers and CO2 tanks sweetening the air for them. If it could adapt to that bizarre atmosphere environment, it would thrive. And what's happened essentially is marijuana has now a whole continent of new habitat, thanks largely to the drug war. What was this, rather mild plant with a THC as the active ingredient of about 3% is up to 15, even 17%. So this marijuana, that you can't even go near without really falling on your face at this point, has evolved, essentially. And we don't normally look at things like the drug war from the point of view of natural history, but from the plant's point of view, which is really what I'm trying to get at in this book, the drug war has been, it's almost like an acid soil for a conifer. Certain kind of plants love an acid soil. Well, the drug war is the acid soil in which marijuana has thrived.
You describe this wave of innovative breeding in the 1980s, performed by people working secretively, growing marijuana indoors. Do you think these people were consciously breeding for certain characteristics in the marijuana? Do you think that they really knew what they were doing in a technical way, or was it just a kind of hit and miss thing that chanced upon a way of growing a hardy marijuana plant indoors?
Well, probably both. There was a lot of we'll try anything and see what works, which is the way evolution works, trial and error. But also, there was an understanding. Whenever you're breeding, you have an end in sight, you have a goal, you have your utopian version of the plant you're working with. And they understood that if marijuana was going to grow in this new environment, it had to get a lot smaller, because you can't grow 16 feet tall plants in an 8-foot high basement or in a little closet. And it had to grow faster, because you didn't really want to stay put if you're growing marijuana, since the police were likely to knock down your door. So they crossed two great strains of the plant. And there was one, a northern strain from Afghanistan, and then there was this tropical strain. Sativa is the tropical strain. Indica is the northern strain. And so they very knowingly put them together, because they understood that Cannabis indica was a much smaller, stouter, very potent plant since it grew in a northern latitude, had to flower and get to seed more quickly than sativa, which took its sweet time about it since it grew near the equator. And they brought these two things together. They also learned along the way, though, that the high associated with each of these strains was very, very different. And the way people talk about it is sativa is a very kind of head high as opposed to a body high. And some people call indica's blue-collar pot. I mean, they're for just if you want to, at the end of the day, you want to just kick back and not think. And sativas allow you to function a lot better. And so they started modulating these effects, and they did create marijuana for different highs, but also to deal with different maladies, because, marijuana, like a lot of plants, is a medicine also. And for certain kinds of, for appetite, one would be better than the other. For pain relief, indicas are supposedly the best. So a lot of this was very deliberate, and I've met a lot of these breeders and growers, and I spent time in Amsterdam and in California meeting with them. And what really hit me was that the best gardeners of my generation, this is what they're doing. They're underground perfecting this plant.
Well, in writing this chapter about marijuana in your new book, The Botany of Desire, you've thought not only about how humans changed the form of marijuana that is grown in the United States. You thought about how marijuana changes our perceptions. And one of the theories you propose is that marijuana may actually remove some of the filters that consciousness normally puts between us and the rest of the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, people talk about marijuana turning us on, but it may be that it turns us off in certain crucial ways. I have to back up a little bit, though. What we've learned about consciousness from the study of marijuana has actually been extraordinary. Allen Ginsberg and those people all said that marijuana would unlock the key to consciousness, and they meant smoking it, of course. But studying it as scientists has, in fact, unlocked some incredible new findings about the brain, about experience, about memory. Basically, what happened was, in trying to figure out why this chemical compound, THC, produced these effects, scientists isolated the brain's own version of THC, which they called anandamide, which is the Sanskrit word for inner bliss. As you can imagine, this was not an American grant from the government funding this research. It was an Israeli neurochemist who named it. And he discovered that there was a neurotransmitter network dedicated to this chemical. And this was completely new. We did not know. You know, sort of we have this opiate network, we have this dopamine network, and now we have this cannabinoid network. And then the question became, well, why? Why did we evolve to have this this network that's activated by this plant, but also this chemical that the brain produces on its own? Now, we didn't evolve to get high on marijuana. We did evolve to respond to anandamide. Anandamide has all the same effects of marijuana. It, for instance, causes short-term memory loss, has a big effect on appetite, has an effect on pain. And so they looked at where these receptors were, and they found them all over the brain, except in the brain stem, which controls involuntary functions like respiration and heartbeat. And that's the reason, since there are no receptors there and that area isn't affected, that it's very hard to overdose from marijuana because it doesn't close down your involuntary functions. They also found it in some surprising places, like the uterus. Now, what was this about? Well, the more they study it, the theory is that anandamide, the brain's own marijuana, is involved in pain control, specifically forgetting pain. And the phenomenon that women often talk about that it's very hard to recover the feeling of labor, you knew it was really horrible, but actually evoking it to yourself is difficult, may be a result of this chemical's ability to help us forget. But it also helps us forget information and other things. And this really baffled me for a long time. And I went back to this Israeli neurochemist. His name is Raphael Meshulam. And I sent him an email and I said, why would we evolve to respond to a chemical that makes us forget things short term? And he wrote back this somewhat elliptical email. And he said, well, do you really want to remember all the faces you saw on the subway this morning? And I had one of those aha moments and realized, well, gee, forgetting is not just a defect of the brain, it's actually a function of the brain. And in fact, it is almost as important as remembering, because we take in so much information. We see so many faces in the course of the day and hear so many advertising jingles, and that unless we can edit all this sense information, we would explode. We'd go crazy. And this may well be the chemical that helps us do that. And there's probably another chemical that helps us lock in long-term memories. So this marijuana chemical is really part of the editing function of the brain. Now, editing is very much what goes on in changes of consciousness. If you read accounts of, and I'm not just talking about drug experiences, I'm talking about sports experience, extreme physical experience, I'm talking about religious experience, you read a lot about people who've managed to immerse themselves in the present moment. And you get the same kind of language, whether you're talking to a Buddhist or talking to a Christian mystic or talking to an athlete. You block out the future, you block out the past, and you're able to seize the present. And that is a process of forgetting. And
so even focusing on things like why, if you're high on marijuana, might food taste more intense than it usually does, or why music might seem more dramatic than it usually does. You think it's because you're blocking out everything else that you might be experiencing?
Yes, you're blocking out all the static of experience. You're focusing on one thing, which, you know, when you smoke marijuana, can almost be a detriment because you just fix so narrowly on something, the rest of the world disappears, and this allows what you are experiencing it allows you to have something a lot closer to direct experience. You know, this chemical, whether in the marijuana form or in your brain's own version, turns us all into transcendentalists and romantics, you know, having that direct experience of nature or ice cream or Jerry Garcia. By the time you get to be an adult, your ability to experience things freshly, sweetness, for example, you know, children experience sweetness almost an intoxication. We kind of lose that.
Did the research that you did on marijuana lead you to find out anything about what frequent smoking might do to the type of short-term memory that you'd like to maintain?
Yeah, it hurts it. You know, if you're a student, it's a very bad thing to do. I didn't explore the whole issue of the negative long-term mental effects of marijuana, although that there is evidence that there are some. And I should be, you know, I want to say that I'm not holding a brief for marijuana or any other drug. And what I think, though, is that, you know, we have a lot of trouble holding two contradictory ideas in our head, that drugs can be wonderful and drugs can be awful, that they're a blessing and a scourge, both. And, you know, the ancient Greeks were much better at this. They understood the power of wine and Dionysus and intoxication. But they also understood that it was such a powerful magic, it could turn you into animals, it could ruin your life. And so they surrounded it around with rituals, and they drank wine out of these tiny little cups, and they took their drug potions only, you know, at one festival every year in the fall. So I think they sort of had a healthier attitude than we do, where every plant is either, you know, this heroic thing that's going to save us or it's going to ruin us. And I think the ability to hold contradictory ideas in our head is a very powerful thing we're not terribly good at.
Well, that said, did this research affect your point of view and on either medical use of marijuana or the decriminalization or legalization of marijuana?
I spent enough time with medical marijuana patients in California to be very impressed with what this drug did for certain individuals, and talked to many, many doctors who swore by its effects, especially on things like certain kinds of pain relief. Marijuana, or anandamide too, doesn't really eliminate pain, but it helps you forget it. And that's really just as important for certain kinds of pain. Appetite. I mean, I saw AIDS patients who were dwindling away to nothing, and a combination of taking testosterone and smoking marijuana would bring them right back up to their normal weight in a matter of months. So it is a powerful medicine. This isn't news. You know, this was discovered by the ancient Chinese and the Indians, and they've known and they've used this for a long time. It's information we've forgotten willfully because, again, we can't tolerate the idea that something that could ruin your life could also help another person's life.
My guest is Michael Pollan, author of the book The Botany of Desire. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Pollan, author of the book The Botany of Desire. It's just been published in paperback. One of the chapters is on marijuana and why American plants are more potent today than in the 60s. Scientists understand a bit about how marijuana intoxicates people when they smoke it, but what does that intoxicant do for the plant itself?
What happens is you have a plant that's doing something for its own reasons, you know, inventing a new chemical. Because this is what plants are really good at. I mean, while we were nailing down consciousness and locomotion and walking on 2 feet, they completely nailed organic chemistry. And they can make compounds that we can't even imagine and manufacture them and design them. And then, of course, there's photosynthesis, which is an astounding trick, turning sunlight into food. Anyway, so they may have done something like this for their own purposes, but then what happens is strictly by chance, some human, or in the case of marijuana, possibly a bird, because birds really like marijuana seeds, probably because they're getting high. Animals do get high as well. And then humans started selecting the plants that produce the most of this chemical. And so gradually the evolutionary destiny of the plant is shaped by the fact that the plants producing the most THC are the ones that are making the most copies of themselves because we're taking those seeds and planting them. But marijuana had an interesting evolution. It unfolded along two paths. While people were selecting the plant for higher and higher levels of THC for medicine or for getting high, they were also selecting the same plant for fiber. And that, of course, is hemp, which until the last century was the most important fiber for both paper making and clothing in the world. So the same plant was developed along that line for the longest, strongest fibers. And then after 10,000 years of this coevolution between us and the plant, you had two families. You had hemp, which has very little THC and really just gives people a headache if they smoke it. And then you have marijuana, cannabis, which is not a terribly good fiber, especially now that they've shortened it down to 2 feet or so. So, you know, evolution is it's really a concatenation of accidents, things that just happen and turn out to have some utility and are seized on. And I think that's probably what happened with opium also. You know, opium is an alkaloid in a flower that seems to repel animals from eating it because it's so bitter. So they start out, you know, they have their own agenda, and then it gets cross-wired with our agenda, and then we're off to the races. I mean, co-evolution is underway. And the plant, after that period, and it's been 10,000 years or so since the invention of agriculture, is a completely different plant. Who's using whom is really the question. And the marijuana plant, you know, yes, we selected it, we developed it, we talk about hybridizing it and changing it, but it makes just as much sense to say that the plant found this unwitting animal that would go to the ends of the earth literally with these seeds and give it this a world's habitat when it started off with just a little part of Eurasia.
So what's in it for the plant? It gets to grow more all over the
exactly.
world.
It gets to conquer the world. It's the old, you know, it's the evolutionary goal. I mean, we shouldn't talk in terms of intent and goals and evolution. It doesn't work that way. But the one sort of life force that we see is the desire to survive and to make more copies, and as you make more copies, expand your range. And all species will do whatever trial and error presents to make that happen. And in the case of these very ingenious species, the domesticated species, what was presented to them was this animal, Homo sapiens, who happened to be very thoughtful and able to change the environment and go all over the world. So if you look at agriculture in general, which happens 10 years ago, you know, we have this phrase, the invention of agriculture. Well, you know, stand back a little and you realize that's kind of conceited. It makes just as much sense if you look at things from a Darwinian point of view to say that agriculture is something that the grasses, because those are the main, you know, the wheat, rice, corn, something the grasses did to get the better of the trees. They got us to cut down the trees. So whenever you mow your lawn, you know, you think that you've got these grasses under your thumb, but in fact, they've got you preserving their habitat, because by mowing the lawn, you're keeping the trees from coming back. There's a war between grasses and trees in evolution. We weighed in on the side of the grasses, and it was the smartest thing the grasses ever did.
Michael Pollan is the author of the book The Botany of Desire. It's just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year when the hardcover edition was published. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new series that explores the issues shaping our world and changing our lives. Friday nights at 9 Eastern on PBS. Local times may vary. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Happiest Baby on the Block, The New Way to Calm Crying and Help Your Baby Sleep Longer by Harvey Karp, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how agribusiness is moving in on the organic food world. We continue our conversation with Michael Pollan. Also, John Powers reviews the new film adaptation of the best-selling novel, The Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood. And Ken Tucker reviews the new hip-hop CD by CeeLo Green. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Pollan. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and often writes about gardening. His book, The Botany of Desire, has just been published in paperback. He investigates how we have bred plants that fulfill our desires, like beauty in tulips, sweetness in apples, and potency in marijuana. And he writes about how agribusiness is changing the world of fruits and vegetables. Agribusiness companies usually devote a large expanse of territory, thousands of acres, to growing one crop year after year. Pollan says this leaves the crops more vulnerable.
If you could put the whole problem of American agriculture into a single word, it is monoculture. Grow the same thing over such a large expanse, and it's genetically identical. It is exquisitely vulnerable to pests. Because the pests are also in a co-evolutionary relationship with the plants, and they are evolving as quickly as they can to unlock the defenses of the plant and consume them, essentially, and eat them. And the plant needs to evolve also to outwit them. The problem with a crop like potatoes or apples that are essentially clones, you're planting genetically identical, you know, all russet Burbanks are the same all over the country, is that the pests get a chance to evolve. And kind of break the locks and get in. So therefore, you've got to come to the rescue of these plants, which are really sitting ducks, and spray lots of chemical. If you were growing with greater diversity, if you had lots of different crops, you wouldn't have the same problem. If you didn't just plant russet Burbanks, which we do essentially because McDonald's needs them because they make the longest, most golden French fry, we wouldn't have the same problem. You know, the potato famine in Ireland, which seems so long ago and far away to us, is we're doing the same thing with the russet Burbank now. That was the reason there was a potato famine is all of Ireland was essentially planting one kind of potato, the lumper. And when a blight came along, which is a fungus that could unlock that potato's defenses overnight, all the lumpers in Europe turned to a black rotting mess. And so monoculture, if there's a single evil, it is that. And the problem is, though, monoculture is very important for driving down the price of food, for, you know, our cheap food economy. I mean, the logic of capitalism drives you toward monoculture. The logic of nature is resisting and driving you toward biodiversity. And there's a fundamental clash between those two systems, I believe.
Well, you visited a lot of organic farms. What do organic farmers do differently?
Organic farms basically nurture the biodiversity in the soil and amongst the plants. They will not grow one kind of potato. They will grow many, many different kinds and many different crops. They won't grow the same crop year after year. And by mixing things up this way, you don't allow the pests, the insects, to build up their numbers. You also have the insects, the pests of one species may indeed help you control the pests of another because it may be a predator. They take care of the soil so that the soil provides a lot of the nutrients, and they grow. Their basic premise is if you take care of the soil, the plants can then take care of themselves because these are plants less dependent on us to come to their rescue with chemicals.
Now, in a recent New York Times Magazine article, you wrote about how agribusiness has taken over a lot of organic food companies. What are some examples of that, of things that you might have seen on the shelf that really were small companies and have now been bought by agribusiness?
Yeah, well, as organic has begun to prove itself in the marketplace, the big companies that sell Americans their food want it in. And, for example, Cascadian Farm is an old organic brand started on a hippie collective farm in the 70s. It's now part of General Mills. You wouldn't know that reading the box. It's still creates this impression of supermarket pastoral of a small farm where people are tending these raspberries very carefully. In fact, they may be coming from as far away as Chile. What's happening is as organic food gets bigger, the same pressures toward monoculture are being felt, and there's a real tension there, and there's reason to worry. I mean, I think organic agriculture still is a great hope for American agriculture. I don't think it's going to solve all the problems. But if it is industrialized, which is starting to happen, you're going to find that it's just as processed. You know, now there are organic TV dinners that are full of synthetics and additives, and there's organic milk that is ultra-pasteurized, which means it's more processed than the regular milk you get. So that there is a danger that as organic catches on, it'll get diluted along the way. And but what happens is if you're selling vast quantities of corn and you're freezing it. The processing machine, even the combine, can't make the turns in a small field, so you end up planting giant fields of all the same variety because that's what processes well, and that's what the processors want. So you see the whole kind of pattern repeating itself, which is definitely a cause for concern.
There are big organic superstores now, stores that are like supermarkets, but they deal only with, you know, quote, organic foods. Is that feeding this trend, too, of organic combining with agribusiness?
Yeah, no question. I mean, Whole Foods and Wild Oats and those companies are selling large quantities of organic. And I should point out, that's a wonderful thing in one way. You know, I mean, here's, again, an example of we have to hold two contradictory ideas in our head. By selling it on this scale, and now I understand Walmart is going to get into organics, when you start selling organic on that scale, you're going to have thousands and thousands of acres being treated organically, and that represents an enormous improvement over what we have. That said, it will not be the same organic as it was when it was smaller, and a lot of these pioneering farmers who developed it will be crushed by the big agribusiness farms. But you know, it's not good or bad. It's very good in some ways. And I saw industrial organic farms where, you know, it was kind of a mixed farm. They'd have 10,000 acres of conventional and 2,000 acres of organic. And the farmers were learning the virtues of organic. And they were switching over to organic pest controls. And they were putting compost in their conventional fields. So there's a cross-pollination going on. And that's a very healthy development.
What are some of the organic pest controls that are used for large organic farms?
Well, this brings us back to our potato story, BT, the pesticide that is put inside those crops. And this is another problem with these crops. It is a bacterial toxin found in the soil called Bacillus thuringiensis. And organic farmers have used it with great success. The way they use it, it breaks down overnight. Just in sunlight, it breaks down. And therefore, the pests have never been able to develop resistance. Now, with all these BT crops, because in addition to potatoes, there's corn that's BT, there's cotton that's BT, we are putting so much of this bacterial toxin in the environment that even the Monsantos of the world acknowledge that pests will develop resistance. And the key organic pest control will not work within 5 to 10 years. So it represents a real taking on the part of this industry of this public good, which is BT.
Well, so the organic food industry would be in trouble if their major pesticides ceased to work.
Yes. I mean, the organic food industry has many threats from genetic engineering, and that's why the two camps have been in such opposition. But genetic modification will probably cost them their most important pesticide, but it's also contaminating their crops because these genes that, you know, we've read about Starlink corn contamination, these genes don't stay put. And, you know, genetic pollution is very different than chemical pollution. Once a gene gets into the environment, it reproduces, it copies itself. So you can't clean it up the way you can an oil spill, and it doesn't fade. So you're getting genes, flounder genes and these kind of things that will be in organic crops as well. So that safe haven that they've set themselves up for will not exist in a few years.
What concerns you most about genetically engineered foods?
Well, I think that the more serious threat is probably environmental, and we probably don't know what it is yet. I think from a health point of view, I'm less worried about health threats from eating it, although they may be there. But environmentally, we are introducing something novel into nature. And whenever we do that, the effects show up where we least expect to find them. You know, DDT is the great case study. I mean, here was this wonderful new chemical. It wasn't terribly toxic to people. It passed all its toxicological tests. We started spraying it like crazy, and it really worked on mosquitoes and malaria in turn. And then suddenly the bird population crashed. No one thought to look at the thickness of birds' eggs, which is essentially what was happening. DDT was staying in the food chain. The birds were eating the bugs. Their eggs were collapsing as they sat on them. When you make a change in nature, because everything is linked, the effect is often very far from where you're looking. And the other problem is we're not looking very hard. You know, these companies, they're not concerned with these relationships the way they should be.
Michael Pollan, where do you get most of your food? Do you grow most of it in your garden?
I wish I could. I grow a fair amount. I've got a large vegetable garden, but I shop at the supermarket like everybody else. But ever since I wrote that article on organics and did the research for this book, I've started to really look around me more closely, and I found some remarkable resources in terms of organic milk that isn't processed at all, in terms of people growing grass-fed beef and farmers markets. So I do as much as I can locally. And given a choice now, given what I've learned, I think between something locally grown and something that's labeled organic in the supermarket, I think I would opt for the local. Because, you know, one of the things, farms give us many things besides food. They give us a kind of landscape. And I like a rural landscape. I like seeing farms in the New England town where I live, and I don't want them to go away. That's another thing they produce. So I buy local when I can.
You say you don't like to see the farms go away. Now, you're one of the urban emigres who have moved to this farm country. Are there a lot of other urban emigres like yourself who have moved out there? And are you part of what's changing the farm landscape?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'm part of the problem. I mean, the farms are disappearing, and a lot of them are being bought by New Yorkers for second homes. But that said, if the people who move to the country will patronize the local farms, then they'll survive. And so it's very, very important to do that and not just assume if you see that organic label that that's the end of the story. Organic is not the last word. I think local. I think a shorter, more legible food chain. I mean, if I learned anything from this, it's, you know, Americans really have forgotten where their food comes from. They think it comes from the supermarket. And the shorter and more legible the food chain is, the healthier will be the agriculture. If, you know, a farmer to farmer's market looks you in the eye and you ask him how he grows his potatoes, and you're going to find out. And that's the best pressure. I mean, a labeling scheme is a substitute for actually meeting the farmers who are growing your food.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Michael Pollan is the author of the book The Botany of Desire. It's just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year when it was published in hardcover. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new hip-hop CD by CeeLo Green. This is Fresh Air. Southern hip-hop continues to be an increasing influence in pop music, with the groups Outkast and the Goody Mob doing for the new century what George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic did for the past 20 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the newest Southern solo act, CeeLo Green, has further extended the genre in a creative way on his solo album, CeeLo Green and His Perfect Imperfections.
Yeah. Yeah, that sure feel good. Hello, I go by the name of Simply CeeLo Green. How do you do? Welcome. I thought I'd seize this opportunity to tell you a little bit more about myself, if you don't mind. This is my vision. You know what I'm saying? Check me out now. I have millenniums of material and rivers of rhythm, an entire ocean of emotion that's enlightening to swim in. Also a forest of feeling, beaten paths of peace. Trapped inside my silhouette, I have to speak to release. Demanding more from the pen than a whore from the pen. The line between playing to win and sin is thin. But I walk it with grace and I talk it with taste. I am that raw, simply put, and I rest my case. It's elementary, yet far more.
Thomas Calloway goes, as he just explained, by the name of CeeLo Green. He's part of the large coalition of Southern hip-hop musicians, the Goody Mob. But on this solo album called CeeLo Green and His Perfect Imperfections, he sounds like a natural star. Loose, assured, in command. On that cut, he very pointedly distances himself from hardcore rap, announcing, "I'm not one of those thug rapper guys." But he does a smart thing. He uses the sly, insinuating beats of the guys he's putting down. Appropriating the best elements from nearby influences to illustrate your own worldview, that's what a lot of hip-hop is about. One thing I like about CeeLo is his encyclopedic command of any number of rhythm and blues styles. Listen to the way he uses a horn section straight out of 1960s Curtis Mayfield music to provide punctuation on a song like this.
Everybody that's wrong, I'm scared of the bone, they got hidden away. Yes, y'all, that's a freaking us all, that's some true not saying. You can't let those who ain't yet make you their little ball of clay. Be free and express yourself, nastiness come naturally. Listen to me now, it could be the way I want to freak a song, tattoos or the way I dress. Or it could be I want to walk my way and refuse and to follow the rest.
Speaking of using older R&B to new effect, CeeLo takes the phrase, "The Great Pretender," from the 1955 hit by The Platters, hears within it the sentiment The Platters were reaching for, that sense of feeling inauthentic, untested and unproven, unworthy of love, and makes his own music from it.
Well, I'm a species so rare, the human eyes hardly seen, the thin line between divine and killing machine, a dark side of the line that no one ever should see. Oh, I feel for the foolish for f***ing with me. There's a war inside me, but the water is still. You'll be safer every time, assuming it will. Yet to lose my composure, I don't normally. I just thought that you should know I've been sicker than you. You don't know me, a record can't tell you. Uh-oh, I'm the great pretender.
This, I think, is what CeeLo is getting at when he refers in his album title to his perfect imperfections. This is the sound of a man struggling with himself, trying to do good by his family and friends, being tempted and resisting temptation to the best of his ability, and sometimes having a very good time fighting these battles. Sometimes he enlists unlikely help, as when he gets John Popper of the band Blues Traveler to play some harmonica on this entirely unironic country music influence tune.
Well, I'm extremely cheap. I snore when I go to sleep. A little bit of nothing I have left, I'm struggling trying to keep. Your friends may all agree, you can name a million things I'll ever be. You feel like flying, feel free. Know that you can do better than me.
I think what I like best about CeeLo Green is his musical open-mindedness, this willingness to bring everything he likes to listen to into his own music. He's making psychedelic, hard-rocking funk music. He's the guy everyone now has to take note of because he's signaling new places to take hip-hop.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed CeeLo Green and his perfect imperfections. Dee Dee Ramone died on Wednesday of what appears to have been an accidental heroin overdose. He was the founding bass player of perhaps the most important American punk band, the Ramones. The band's lead singer, Joey Ramone, died last year. Here's one of Dee Dee Ramone's songs. This is Teenage Lobotomy.
I got it.
The Ramones. Dee Ramone died Wednesday at the age of 50. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film adaptation of the best-selling novel The Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood. This is Fresh Air. The new movie, The Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, is based on the best-selling novel by Rebecca Wells. The film stars Sandra Bullock, Ellen Burstyn, Maggie Smith, and Ashley Judd. It was directed by Callie Khoury, who wrote the screenplay for the movie Thelma and Louise. Film critic John Powers has a review.
The Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood is one of the publishing triumphs of the last decade. Rebecca Wells' novel has sold millions of copies, nearly all of them to women. At my parents' retirement community in Iowa, my mother and her friends talk about the book in the rapturous tones of teenage boys raving up the matrix. The Yaya Sisterhood hits them where they live. When a book is this beloved, it's only a matter of time before Hollywood puts it on screen, usually to dismal effect. And I must admit that I feared the worst after seeing the trailers and TV spots for the movie, which made it resemble a carnival of biddies all hamming it up in a desperate attempt to be funny. But this is one case where a film is better than its ads. Sandra Bullock stars as Sidda, a famous New York playwright who tells Time magazine some harsh things about her drama queen mother Vivi back in Louisiana. Mom's played by Ellen Burstyn, and she's furious. Enter the Yaya Sisterhood, a magic circle of girlfriends created back in the 1930s by Vivi and her three closest pals, who've been inseparable ever since. Hoping to reconcile mother and daughter, the sisterhood, played by Lois Smith, Maggie Smith, and Fionnuala Flanagan, kidnap Sidda and take her back home to Louisiana. There they show her a big scrapbook dubbed The Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, which tells the story of Vivi's life. Through a series of flashbacks, Sidda learns the hard truth about her mother, played in earlier years by Ashley Judd, and she discovers the giddy facts of her mother's friendship with the Yayas. Not that this solves anything, for Vivi is a real piece of work, and everybody knows it. Here, Sidda is being driven mad by the Yaya's attempt to get her back together with her mother.
Before y'all start, I have just one thing to say. It's not gonna work.
Listen, petite bébé, no one on earth, and I mean no one, understands better than us how crazy your mama is. We're not here to dispute that. She's mad as a hatter, that's never gonna change.
The very fact that your mama is the way she is, if you really knew, well, it's nothing less than a triumph of the will.
I'm sorry, did you say will or pill?
Don't you take that tone with her. You want to get all scrappy, you deal with me.
That is just it. I don't want to get all scrappy. I am sick to death of this whole center of the universe. Holier than thou. Oh, how I've suffered. Nobody understands me. Somebody fix me a drink and hand me a Nembutal worn out Scarlet O'Hara thing.
Well, she's got her pegged all right.
The Yaya Sisterhood is the directorial debut of screenwriter Callie Khoury, who launched her career with the script for Thelma and Louise, perhaps the most daringly feminist movie in Hollywood history. It says something about the conservative drift of the film industry, if not of our whole culture, that 11 years later, she would be making a bittersweet story about acceptance rather than rebellion, a film with obvious affinity to such corny southern fried yak fests as Steel Magnolias and Fried Green Tomatoes. Khoury has said that when she saw Steel Magnolias, she wanted to shoot herself, and I wouldn't be surprised if her trigger finger didn't get a bit itchy during the first half hour of her own movie. For it's filled with characters yelling, pounding phones on tables, and performing other hijinks intended to convince us that what we're seeing is side-splittingly funny. The woman next to me at the screening was from Louisiana, and she was aghast at both the actress's accents and the gargoylish way the South was being represented. But the movie collects itself as it goes along. Corey wins some funny character work from Flanagan and Maggie Smith, and a genuinely touching turn from James Garner as Sita's weak-willed dad. He knows how to underplay. As the broad comedy recedes, the story begins to touch an emotional chord grounded in common experience. It's no accident that mother-daughter stories like the Ya-Ya Sisterhood or the Joy Luck Club are so popular, for they tap into one of the archetypal sagas of the modern era. How women raised with today's freedoms must come to terms with earlier generations of women, especially their mothers, who were raised with far different values and penned in by far different expectations. Vivi may be crazy, but it's partly because she's a larger-than-life woman trapped in a world too small for her yearnings, yearnings her daughter Sita gets to live out. In the old world, which can be fairly termed a man's world, many women's deepest and most nourishing relationships were with other women, with whom they could express parts of themselves they couldn't show anyone else. Although some of the comic bits in the Ya-Ya Sisterhood are positively excruciating, I found parts of the film quite moving. Never more so than in its portrait of this group of four friends, all now old, who've spent their lifetimes getting to know one another better than they could ever be known by any man. I suspect that this is what Callie Khouri finds appealing in the story, too. The Ya-Ya sisters may not drive into the Grand Canyon at the end of the film, but like Thelma and Louise, they know that their true loyalties lie with the world of women.
John Powers is executive editor and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross. Our associate producer, Megan Howell, is getting married this weekend. We think her husband-to-be is a genuinely lucky guy. Congratulations, and have a great honeymoon.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at vermontvacation.com. And National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new movie Undercover Brother is a satire of the black action films of the 70s and racial stereotypes of today. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with screenwriter John Ridley. He also has a new novel about an African-American comic trying to make it in the 60s. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.